The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from the wellness section, The Daily Emotional Detox. Welcome to your real-life guide to healing trauma. Humans have undergone shock, event, an attachment, relational, trauma for centuries, and we've evolved many ways of maintaining the best health possible under a variety of circumstances. The goal of this routine is to help anyone develop a lifestyle aimed at healing traumatic responses in the brain and body. It's based on the typical day of a person who works 9 to 5 in an away-from-home workplace. Feel free to adjust the times of day as needed. An important disclaimer is that you might need a medical opinion about some of these suggestions, so ask your healthcare team to collaborate on your personal routine. 7 a.m. The first thing many of us do in the morning is take a shower. The question is, hot or cold or both? Evidence suggests that exposing yourself to cold or cycling between the two temperatures is best for your system. According to Wim Hof, the Dutch iceman who jumps into cold water and does an adaptation of ancient breathing exercises, cold temps can help regulate the nervous system and produce endorphins or happiness hormones. Certainly, if your body is stuck in a lower activation response, the cold can wake it up. But research shows it can also improve sleep, reduce stress, help with concentration, and increase energy levels. 9 a.m. Ah, the commute. If you're the kind of person who's constantly shouting at passing cars and white-knuckling your steering wheel, you have too much fight energy from your sympathetic nervous system. When you feel road rage, think of it as an opportunity to practice shifting your nervous system in the moment. Try to notice 5 colors in the passing cars, or 10 license plates with vowels. Look for people walking their dogs or wearing sneakers. Play calming music. Helping your mind pay attention to more neutral things is a superb skill to practice. 10 a.m. Take a coffee or tea break. When your activated nervous system kicks in from the stress of the workday, a straightforward way to counteract it is with digestion. Swallowing or going to the bathroom is enough, since engaging any part of the gastrointestinal tract activates the parasympathetic, so-called rest and digest system. Sip often from a water bottle to prevent getting overloaded with stress, and don't ignore body cues to visit the washroom. This is a fantastic way to practice interoception or listening to signals from our body. Something many of us have learned to ignore when we've been in situations where we had to suppress internal messages. 11 a.m. Incorporate some rhythmic movement into your day, whether it's tapping your feet one at a time on the floor or tapping your palm against your thigh or collarbone points. Drum your fingers on the desk if you're not in an open concept office. Patterned and repetitive movement includes taking a walk. So get up to refill your water or check in on a colleague. Many brains benefit from the Pomodoro technique, where you concentrate on learning or working for a set amount of time and then grab a break. Try a 25-minute work stretch followed by a 5-minute break. Noon. Let's presume that your sympathetic nervous system is in overdrive, as work is a potentially stressful environment. Your lunch should be tied to reducing anxiety in the brain. Skip fried food, sweetened drinks, heavy red meat, and easily digested carbohydrates like white rice or potatoes. All are suboptimal to a brain that has been through trauma. According to Harvard psychiatrist Uma Naidoo, that's N-A-I-D-O-O, author of This Is Your Brain on Food, Dietary fiber is the principal ingredient that promotes growth of healthy bacteria in the gut. Think beans, brown or black rice, bran, fruits with skin, oats, and almonds or walnuts. Another nutrient that's helpful in reducing anxiety through anti-inflammatory properties in the brain is omega-3 acid. Fish and other seafood are the best source. Vegetarian sources include flax or chia seeds and tofu. Fermented foods, kimchi or sauerkraut, miso and tempeh, cider vinegar and plain yogurt also improve the microbiome and decrease anxiety. A handful of blueberries for antioxidant properties, which cleans up damaging molecules like Pac-Man, is a great way to finish a calming lunch break. 1 p.m. Is there any way to spend more time on your own? A brain that has survived trauma needs both time for connection and time for solitude. If your work environment promotes one of these scenarios, is there a way to find yourself more of the other? 2 p.m. Get up and move again. In her book, The Extended Mind, science writer Annie Murphy-Paul describes how movement and gestures can stimulate the brain. In fact, our memory works better when we are in motion. Anytime the brain is functioning better, rewiring it towards safety is more available to us. 3 p.m. Time for a healthy snack to keep our digestive tract working and our calm nervous system engaged. Grab a kombucha or kefir. These fizzy fermented drinks replenish the good bacteria in our system. 5 p.m. On your way home, find ways to relax the body and make a clear transition from the workday. Meditation can be hard for a person whose brain is programmed to send danger signals. When you quiet your mind, those signals can sound even louder. Mindful practices, simple acts like driving or walking, can be just as powerful as sitting still. When you're in motion, heading home perhaps, what can you notice about where you are? How many clouds are in the sky? What do the trees look like and are they moving in the wind? Be careful not to be too distracted if you're driving, of course. Notice even more details. The sparkle of sunshine reflecting off ice. The joy of a dog running with a stick in its mouth. How some people dress for one season while others seem prepared for a completely different one. Things you notice that are beautiful or playful are best for the nervous system. 6 p.m. Our body may feel more relaxed after a busy workday, and we don't want it to tip into the underactive nervous system response. To that end, follow the lunch advice above for dinner, but try to also incorporate probiotics, which grow our healthy gut bacteria. Found in plain yogurt, tempeh, miso, and other fermented foods, as well as cheeses like cheddar, mozzarella, and gouda. Prebiotics, which support the process of growing healthy bacteria, are also key. You can find them in beans and other legumes, bananas, garlic, onions and leeks, and asparagus. 8 p.m. Connecting with others is an important way to practice using your attuned nervous system, also known as the ventral vagal. Spend time with your partner, kids, or pet, or call a parent or friend. 10 p.m. For ideal sleep, quiet your brain. Turn off your worries with an app that produces colored noises, or turn on a fan or humidifier. If you have difficulty falling asleep and you have a set of earbuds or headphones that differentiate right from left ears, try Binaural Beats for Insomnia, free online. 11 p.m. Aim to keep the same routine during the weekday and weekends. Our system runs on an internal clock of hormones and neurotransmitters that's hard to switch for a couple of days every week. Then incorporate some of these ideas into your wind-down routine. Drink warm tea or milk. Pet an animal or get cozy in a soft blanket. Use an essential oil diffuser. Turn on a fan or other source of white noise or a small water feature. Write in a gratitude journal. Read a book. Good night, sweetheart. You are loved. Okay, we're moving over to culture and news. Elliot Page reveals 6 books that made a difference. The actor and advocate revisits books that left a lasting impact. In his highly anticipated memoir, Page Boy, actor Elliot Page shares intimate stories about secret love affairs, battling body image, and struggling with family discord. Out now, the book delves into the universal human experience of searching for one's true self. Page skyrocketed to fame and earned an Oscar nomination for his role in 2007's Juno. Popular movies like Inception and Whippet followed, cementing his status as a respected actor. From the outside, it was easy to assume Page had it all, but internally he was struggling to find his place. In 2014, Page publicly came out as gay, and in 2020, he shared that he was trans. His memoir details much of his experience and describes how he found joy. Here, he shares books that inspired him along his journey. Miss Major Speaks Conversations with a Black Trans Revolutionary. I hope everyone reads this. Miss Major speaks with such profound wisdom, highlighting the realities for Black trans women and how much the mainstream LGBTQ+ movements has left the most vulnerable behind and purposefully excluded those who are responsible for the groundbreaking acts of resistance that have changed our culture. If there's a book to read and someone to listen and learn from, it's Miss Major. Ties That Bind: Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. Read this if you have queer people in your family, which means everyone should read this. Sarah Schulman never let us off the hook in the best possible ways. She shows us that these are not just individual problems, but a societal crisis, a book I have read and reread many times over. Punch Me Up to the Gods, a memoir. I couldn't put this down. Even the painful parts that were hard to read. Brian Broome's, and that's B-R-O-O-M-E, writing is unparalleled. The way he tells his story helped me be more complete with the details I chose to reveal about my own life. Whole paragraphs in this book left me audibly gasping. Amateur, A Reckoning with Gender, Identity, and Masculinity. Thomas explores what it is to be a man through his journey of becoming the first trans man to box in Madison Square Garden. He investigates how we define masculinity and what type of man he wants to be. This is such a unique, true story, one that inspired me and offered me hope, and it's so beautifully written. Black on Both Sides, A Racial History of Trans Identity. C. Riley Snorton's Black on Both Sides is full of essential information about historical intersections between blackness and transness. Snorton draws a direct line from the past to what we are witnessing today with anti-trans legislation, highlighting the erasure of the black trans experience and representation throughout history. How to Write an Autobiographical Novel, Essays. Alexander Chee intertwines his personal story with broader political and social issues. In this powerful and intimate essays, he explores the process and importance of writing, what it means to be honest with oneself, and what it means to learn about who we are and crack ourselves open to tell our truth. We're in TV and movies. Kim Cattrall will appear in And Just Like That, Season 2. The actress is set to reprise her role for the second season of the HBO series. Samantha Jones is heading back to our screens. Yes, you read that correctly. The iconic PR powerhouse is returning for the second series of And Just Like That. Kim Cattrall, who played Samantha during the original Sex and the City series from 1998 to 2004, as well as in the two films, is confirmed to be making a cameo appearance in HBO's spin-off series, according to Variety. The actress will appear in one scene, which reportedly involves a phone conversation between herself and Carrie Bradshaw. She is not expected to appear with any of the other characters on screen or as part of the ensemble cast. Cattrall's character was referenced throughout the first season of And Just Like That, with Samantha texting Carrie about meeting up while she also sent flowers on the day of Mr. Big's funeral. The news of her return will come as a big surprise to many Sex and the City fans. following a long public feud between Cattrall and Sarah Jessica Parker, with the actress reportedly refusing to take part in the first season of the reboot. Previously, Cattrall detailed how Parker prevented her from forming close relationships with Nixon and Davis throughout the show's filming, as well as calling Parker cruel in a 2018 Instagram post. HBO's chief content officer, Casey Bloys, has said previously that Samantha's absence was always going to be a part of the show's overall storyline. They aren't trying to redo Sex and the City. They're not trying to say that these characters are reliving their 30s, Bloys said of season one. It is very much a story about women in their 50s, and they are dealing with things that people deal with in their 50s. He added, just as in real life, people come into your life, people leave, friendships fade, and new friendships start. So I think it's all very indicative of the real stages, the actual stages of life. Either way, we can't wait to see Jones back on our screens, even if only for a cameo. Okay, from TV and movies, Gayle King is showcasing women making waves this May. Prepare your vocal cords for a jam-packed month that includes a Beyoncé tour, The Little Mermaid, and so much more. The world, according to Gayle, is Oprah Daily's video series spotlighting all things Gayle, each and every month. Our editor-at-large is sharing her favorites of the moment, from buzzy new albums to fantastic restaurant finds you'll want to try. Check back each month to see the latest. Can anyone believe we're already 5 months into the year? May is here, and it's full of reasons to celebrate and moments to look out for. I always like to mention holidays, and this month we have National Teacher Appreciation Day on May 2nd, Cinco de Mayo on May 5th, and National Hamburger Day on May 28th. Anyone who knows me knows that I will be celebrating. This month, I'm especially looking forward to Mother's Day. Out of all my gigs, being there for favorite daughter Kirby, favorite son Will, favorite son-in-law Virgil, and favorite grandson Luca is the most important role I play. Not sure what to do for your mom or maternal figure this year? I'll tell you, there's no better gift than giving your presence and spending time together. All that to say, let's get going on all the new releases I'm excited about this month. Fatal Attraction on Paramount. When the movie Fatal Attraction first came out, wives and girlfriends everywhere were taking their men to the movies as a cautionary tale to anyone who may consider being a cheater, pumpkin eater. It was a cultural phenomenon, and now Paramount Plus has picked up on the narrative with a new, reimagined series. The series, like the original, tells the story of obsession and infidelity and how quickly your life can unravel from a web of lies. You can stream it now. Beyoncé's Renaissance World Tour. Hear ye, hear ye. The Queen is back. Queen Bey, that is. Beyoncé is on the road again for her first solo tour in 7 years for her album Renaissance, which came out in July 2022. The tour kicks off this month in Stockholm, Sweden, and the staff here at Oprah Daily are prepping their vocal cords. I am so ready to see the costumes and the dance moves and Club Renaissance. I want to hear from you. Are you going to see Beyoncé on tour? Let us know which city you're hitting in the comments. Disney's Little Mermaid. Making a splash on your screens on May 26th is Disney's live-action remake of The Little Mermaid, starring Hailey Bailey as Ariel, Melissa McCarthy as Ursula, Javier Bardem as King Triton, and David Diggs voicing Sebastian the Crab, to name a few. There has been so much hype around this release, and deservedly so. Bailey, who is already Grammy-nominated, shared the full rendition of Part of Your World, and it's sure to sweep some wins. It's beautiful. Her role as Ariel has been making a world of a difference for little black girls everywhere. Mattel even created a Little Mermaid Ariel doll in her image. I can't wait to finally see this old classic come back to life. Succession on HBO. I have to take a moment to talk about Succession, which I highlight not because there are new episodes, but because it's coming to an end this month with season 4. prepared to say goodbye to the Roys, the power-hungry siblings who used their skills and wealth, and sometimes tools of betrayal, to place their bid on the family dynasty led by the patriarch and business mogul Logan Roy. We've already seen some plot twists this season, and at this point, I can't wait to get to the bottom of how it ends and who ends up on top. Watch or stream the series finale on May 28th on HBO and HBO Max. Premium Goods. When I spoke to Jennifer Ford on CBS Mornings about her history-making business based in Houston, I just knew I had to feature her on Oprah Daily. Ford is the owner of Premium Goods, which makes her the only black female founder of an American sneaker retailer. Jennifer was invited to design two Nike Air Force Ones and sent me some to try. The shoes are both stylish and comfortable, and one of a kind. In Work and Money, Oprah and Edward Enninful discuss his journey to leading British Vogue. Oprah sat down with her friend Enninful to discuss his new memoir, A Visible Man, which explores his upbringing and path to British Vogue. Edward Enninful's keen eye for style has led him to dominate the world of European fashion magazines. Enninful is both the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, as well as the European editorial director of Vogue. His latest mission is to share his barrier-breaking story in his new memoir, A Visible Man. Oprah and Enninful first met in 2018, when Oprah was featured on the cover of British Vogue. Oprah thinks of Enninful as her dear friend, and he lovingly refers to her as the Empress, inspired by the royalty-themed shoot and cover story Oprah starred in. Oprah and Enninful sat down together for the latest Super Soul podcast episode, where they discussed A Visible Man. The memoir follows Enninful's journey as a refugee who essentially broke the glass ceiling to become British Vogue's first black editor-in-chief. Read on for a few noteworthy moments from their conversation and watch, you can see their entire interview. Enninful opens up about his childhood. Enninful shares that he grew up in Ghana as a quiet kid. Enninful's father was tough, which led him to spend a great deal of time with his mother, who consistently created an environment that made him feel safe. He was raised on a military base in a coastal town where he was surrounded by mostly other black people, allowing him to view black as beautiful. In fact, according to Enninful, the idea of black not being beautiful was very alien to him, until he made it to England and experienced the culture shock of realizing that blackness was viewed differently in other parts of the world. Enninful shares that today, when people meet him and learn of his power in the fashion world, they not only assume he's from England, but they often don't know the journey he had to take before getting to his position. A Visible Man is his opportunity to paint the full picture of his success. I wanted them to see the struggles, not just the highs, the lows, Enninful says. I wanted them to know that it is possible, no matter how many people tell you you can't, it is possible. The impact of his health struggles. Enninful was born with a blood disorder called thalassemia and the genetic trait for sickle cell, but he also eventually developed a condition impacting the key part of his body that enables him to do what he loves, his eyes. My retina's detached 4 times, Enninful says. I mean, my eye is really, it's really what I need to survive. At the height of struggling with the condition, Enninful had to ask himself, if he couldn't see the work he dedicates so much time to creating, then who would he be? The answer to that question is that even while creating using one eye, Enninful is still an impactful visionary with just a little more reliance on his vast imagination. When you can't see, you're given something else, Enninful says. And I can imagine when I close my eyes, I can imagine the most beautiful, the most incredible, because I can't physically see so well. His thoughts on his duty to the magazine world. Enninful believes it's his responsibility to create content that is reflective of the times we live in, especially when it comes to the importance of inclusivity in their coverage. In the wake of George Floyd's murder, Eninfo worked on an issue that featured 30 activists, people who were putting their lives on the line just for us. When you go back, stories I've done, whether it's about plastic surgery or Hollywood, it's about the times we live in, Eninfo says. For me, that's when art is art, not just for art's sake. Parts of this article were edited due to time. We're over in books now. This article is The Oprah's Book Club Conversation with Finding Me, author Viola Davis, explores her pain and triumph. Oprah and the award-winning actress talk legacy, warrior fuel, and owning your story in an interview exclusively on Oprah Daily. Oprah's book club conversation between Oprah and Viola Davis, whose remarkable memoir, Finding Me, shot to number one on the New York Times bestseller list in its first week on sale, premiered on Monday. In Finding Me, which is the 95th Oprah's book club selection, the Tony Oscar and Emmy-winning actress recalls her family's early struggles with poverty, domestic violence, and racism, and how she finally came to terms with all she suffered and triumphed. But, as becomes clear in the upcoming interview, that triumph didn't come easily. Keep reading for highlights. What kept her going even in the darkest times? Davis calls it warrior fuel, something inside her that kept her from giving in to defeat, a power she hopes her 11-year-old daughter, Genesis, will inherit. There's something about being an older parent, Davis tells Oprah and guests, that focuses you on legacy, on what you are leaving behind. It's like running a relay race, she says. Your job is to run a leg of the race and pass the baton to the next great runner with as much strength and force as possible. For Davis, her daughter is that next great runner. Among the reasons Davis chose to write the book and not to hold anything back is that I don't want to be a secret to Genesis. The people who are on the weakest foundations are those who spend a huge amount of time covering up their stories. Then anyone can come over and topple you over by revealing them. In writing the book, Davis takes ownership of her own story. A central element of that story is colorism. When you are a dark-skinned girl, she writes, no one simply adores you. She had to grapple with feeling ugly and unseen, and later to acknowledge the role it played in my pain. Ultimately, she concludes that beauty is not a value. And as she says to one Oprah Daily insider, I have not read on anyone's tombstone, 50 million found me to be very beautiful. Davis shares her belief in the power of no as a means of establishing and maintaining clear-cut boundaries in her professional and personal lives so that she can create a sacred space for myself. When Oprah asks her if that means she's had to leave certain friendships behind, she admits that, yes, there were people who used telling the truth even when it hurts as an excuse to be mean. And yet Davis also exhibits her light side. She notes that she and her husband Julius go to bed laughing and wake up laughing, and that Genesis is her great joy. At 56 years old, the first black artist to earn the so-called Triple Crown, Tony, Oscar, Emmy, has embraced the 8-year-old Viola, who she realizes was pretty tough. She survived. We're in Oprah's Insider section. Oprah challenges you to do one good deed every day. But what I know for sure is that true success comes only when you're happy and fulfilled doing the work. And the way to get there is by giving of yourself to other people. Hi, Oprah Insiders. Happy Sunday to you. You know, graduation season is in full swing. I'm still going to graduations because my daughter girls are still graduating. I mean, I thought I was done. But then there were master's degrees and there's doctorate degrees. They just keep going to school. One of my daughter girls, actually two of them, graduated. One with a master's degree from Columbia this past week and another with a law degree from UPenn. It is so exciting just for me to see the fulfillment of a dream with these girls. Girls who I picked when they were 12 years old now because the masters of their fates and the captains of their souls. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful rewarding experience for me. I had another incredible experience a couple of weeks ago. I was invited back to Tennessee State University, my alma mater, as a commencement speaker. You know, commencement speeches are challenging because so many people say the same things, and you have a graduating class that just wants to get their degree and walk across the stage and are already bored the moment you stand up. I'm always trying to be thoughtful about what to say that's going to be meaningful. One of the things that I said at my graduation speech for Tennessee State University recently that I think applies not just to the students who are graduating, but to all of us. Everybody thinks and is told that you need to make a difference in the world. And you want to be able to do that. You think that it must be big things. It must be finding the best job and being a great success and making a lot of money. But what I know for sure is that true success comes only when you're happy and fulfilled doing the work. And the way to get there is by giving of yourself to other people. It doesn't start with big things. It starts with one small thing. So I was trying to tell the students that you just need to do one kind, good thing for one person every day. Just start to make that a habit, whether it's smiling at somebody or leaving the door open for somebody or offering kindness whenever you can. I'm asking you, insiders, to do the same thing this week, and then to let me know what it is in the comments. Tell me the one thing you did every day. I believe that the goodness you give to someone else is going to come back to you tenfold. Let's try it as an intentional experiment this week, doing one good thing for another person every day. Then tell me about it. Go well, and have a beautiful week. This is in Culture and News. Drew Barrymore calls out tabloids for twisting recent comments about her mom. I have never said that I wish my mother was dead. How dare you put those words in my mouth? Drew Barrymore is adding more context to comments she made in a New York Magazine profile about her mother and calling out tabloids for twisting her words. During the interview, Barrymore overheard the distant sounds of neighbors and said, "All their moms are gone, and my mom's not, and I'm like, well, I don't have that luxury. But I cannot wait. I don't want to live in a state where I wish someone to be gone sooner than they're meant to be so I can grow. I actually want her to be happy and thrive and be healthy, but I have to grow in spite of her being on this planet." Later in the interview, Barrymore circled back to her previous comment and said, "I dared to say it, and I didn't feel good. I do care. I'll never not care. I don't know if I've ever known how to fully guard, close off, not feel, build the wall up." Barrymore clarified her comments in a video posted to Instagram, calling out tabloid coverage of the quotes and saying, "I have never said that I wish my mother was dead. How dare you put those words in my mouth? I have been vulnerable and tried to figure out a very difficult, painful relationship while admitting it is difficult to do while a parent is alive. And that, for those of you who have to figure that out in real time, cannot wait. As in they cannot wait for the time, not that the parent is dead. Don't twist my words around or ever say that I wish my mother was dead. I have never said that. I never would. In fact, I can go on to say that I wish that I never have to live in an existence where I would wish that on someone, because that is sick." That article was edited due to time. Still in news, this article is Prince Harry testifies about utterly vile British tabloids. "It was a downward spiral whereby the tabloids would constantly try and coax me, a damaged young man, into doing something stupid that would make a good story and sell lots of newspapers." Prince Harry took the witness stand today in his case against Mirror Group Newspapers, MGN. In doing so, the Duke of Sussex became the first senior British royal to give evidence in over 130 years. The last time a royal testified was when Edward VII testified in a slander trial in 1891. At the same time he appeared in court, Prince Harry's legal team released the royal's written witness statement covering what he will discuss. That 55-page document is full of insight into their legal strategy. Particularly of note in the witness statement is the section entitled "My Relationship with the Tabloid Press," which details Prince Harry's feelings about the tabloids, and, in essence, the impetus for this entire case. Here, the key passages from that section and from the conclusion about his case against the Mirror Group. Number one, the tabloids led Harry to a downward spiral. It is no secret that I have had, and continue to have, a very difficult relationship with the tabloid press in the UK, Prince Harry begins. In my experience as a member of the royal family, each of us gets cast into a specific role by the tabloid press. You can start off as a blank canvas while they work out what kind of person you are and what kind of problems and temptations you might have. They then start to edge you towards playing the role or roles that suit them best and which sells as many newspapers as possible, especially if you are the spare to the heir. You're then either the playboy prince, the failure, the dropout, or in my case, the thicko, the cheat, the underage drinker, the irresponsible drug taker. The list goes on. He continues that the tabloids led him into a downward spiral, calling their behavior utterly vile. Harry writes, "As a teenager, and in my early 20s, I ended up feeling as though I was playing up to a lot of the headlines and stereotypes that they wanted to pin on me, mainly because I thought that if they are printing this rubbish about me and people were believing it, I may as well do the crime, so to speak." It was a downward spiral whereby the tabloids would constantly try and coax me, a damaged young man, into doing something stupid that would make a good story and sell lots of newspapers. Looking back on it now, such behavior on their part is utterly vile. Number two, the tabloids wanted me to be single. The Duke of Sussex then continues to discuss the impact the tabloids have had on his romantic relationships, past and present. Whilst they would, of course, report on my successes in life, it seemed to me they took far greater pleasure in knocking me down, time and time again. This extended to my relationships, he writes. I always felt as if the tabloids wanted me to be single, as I was much more interesting to them and sold more newspapers. And whenever Prince Harry did date, he says the tabloids were very keen to report the details, but would then, very quickly, seek to try and break it up by putting as much strain on it and creating as much distrust as humanly possible, as I shall go into in more detail later in this statement. This twisted objective is still pursued to this day, even though I'm now married. That last sentence is perhaps a nod to the coverage of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's relationship. He adds, "Whenever I have been in a relationship, I have always tried to be the best partner that I possibly could, but every woman has her limit. Unfortunately, they are not just in a relationship with me, but with the entire tabloid press as the third party." Though Prince Harry says he accepts he has a public role within the British royal family, he argues no level of privacy has ever existed for him. Despite the common misconception, "I was no more than 5% funded by the taxpayer while I was a working royal in the UK. Yet it felt as though the tabloid press thought that they owned me, absolutely, and deserved to know everything there is to know about me, my life, my movements, and the lives of those people who came into my orbit." Number three, "I have always tried to take as my duty to stand up to things which are wrong." The next section is where he specifically gets into unlawful information gathering and the crux of the trial. There also seems to be a real blurring of the lines in terms of what is in the public interest and what is of interest to the public. The tabloids concentrated on salacious stories about my relationships and so on to satisfy the latter, while appearing to completely ignore the former, as a means of justifying their intrusion. Prince Harry writes, "I simply don't understand, and never have, how the inner, private details of my relationships, for example, could have anything to do with the well-being of society or the running of the country, and therefore be in the public interest, or, indeed, how the use of voicemail interception and other unlawful information-gathering techniques to uncover such private information could be either." He notes that he understands that his relationships would be of interest, but what I complain of here is illegal or unlawful, and that is something which I feel incredibly strong about, not just in personal capacity, but as part of the role I have always tried to take as my duty, to stand up to things which are wrong, and the public or people without the same resources should not have to accept or undergo. Prince Harry has previously said that changing the media landscape in the UK is his life's work. Number four, he faced preconceived notions about being a thicko. Prince Harry argues that the tabloid coverage of his life created an alternative and distorted version of me that preceded him whenever he went. It even got to the stage where the tabloids would routinely publish articles about me that were often wrong, but interspersed with snippets of truth, which I now think was most likely gleaned from voicemail interception and or unlawful information gathering, Harry writes. This created an alternative and distorted version of me and my life to the general public, being those people that I had to serve and interact with as part of my role in the royal family, to the point where any one of the thousands of people that I met or was introduced to on any given day could easily have gone, "You know what? You're an idiot. I've read all the stories about you, and now I know I'm now going to stab you." This extended to every new place that I went to, whether it be a classroom at school or a new course in the army. I always wondered when walking into a room of unknown people whether they had all read these stories and what judgment they had already formed based on what they'd read in the tabloids. He says that whatever advantage people claimed I had by walking into a room as Prince Harry was immediately flipped on its head because I was facing judgments and opinions based on what had been reported about me, true or not true. I expected people to be thinking he's obviously going to fail this test because he's a thicko. For example, Prince Harry writes, if you were one of the examiners for the regular commissions board, for instance, then you're going to expect me to screw up as you've already made an opinion before even meeting me, based on the tabloid reports. It meant that I felt that I never went in at the same level as everybody else because the spotlight was always on me. Number five, tabloid behavior is criminal. The section on his relationship with the tabloids ends with a powerful statement. I genuinely feel that in every relationship that I've ever had, to be with that with friends, girlfriends, with family, or with the army, there's always been a third party involved, namely the tabloid press. Having seen me grow up from a baby, being born into this contractual relationship without any choice, and scrutinized by every move, the tabloids have known the challenges and mental health struggles that I have had to deal with throughout my childhood and adult life, and for them to then play on that and use it to their own advantage, I think is, well, criminal. Number six, Prince Harry thinks we need to save journalism as a profession. Outside of the section on his relationship with the tabloids, his mirror group claim sectioning is also fascinating. It features the Duke of Sussex take on why he is doing this. In my view, in order to save journalism as a profession, journalists need to expose those people in the media that have stolen or hijinked the privileges and powers of the press and have used illegal or unlawful means for their own gain and agendas, Prince Harry writes. He adds, in the same vein, I am bringing this claim not because I hate the tabloid press or even necessarily a section of it, but in order to properly hold the people who have hijacked those privileges which come with being a member of the press to account for their actions. Number seven, the state of the UK press and government are at rock bottom. Prince Harry continues that he has unique perspective on this issue. He writes that this is personal for him. This has become a huge problem of which I have a unique perspective and experience, perhaps having had a front row seat to it. Because they have showed no willingness to change, I feel that I need to make sure that this unlawful behavior is exposed, because obviously I don't want anybody else going through the same thing that I've been going through on a personal level. The royal also takes a wider view, writing, on a national level, as at the moment our country is judged globally by the state of our press and our government, both of which I believe are rock bottom. Democracy fails when your press fails to scrutinize and hold the government accountable, and instead choose to get into bed with them so they can ensure the status quo. I may not have a role within the institution, but as a member of the British royal family and as a soldier upholding important values, I feel there's a responsibility to expose this criminal activity in the name of public interest. The country and the British public deserve to know the depth of what was actually happening then and indeed now. We will be better off for it. Another article, Tyler James Williams shares an important message about sexuality during Pride Month. The Abbott Elementary Star is committed to rejecting dangerous stereotypes for gay and straight people alike. We're used to seeing Tyler James Williams keep things laconic and buttoned up as the taciturn teacher Gregory Eddy in Abbott Elementary, but in real life he's a lot more expressive. The actor, who first rose to fame in the sitcom Everybody Hates Chris, just shared an impassioned message on his Instagram story in which he pushed back against the culture of speculating about other people's sexuality. "Usually I wouldn't address stuff like this, but I feel like it has a conversation is bigger than me," he wrote. "I'm not gay, but I think the culture of trying to find some kind of hidden trait or behavior that a closeted person lets slip is very dangerous. Overanalyzing someone's behavior in an attempt to catch them directly contributes to the anxiety a lot of queer and queer-questioning people feel when they fear living in their truth. It makes the most pedestrian of conversations and interactions in spaces feel less safe for our gay brothers and sisters and those who may be questioning. It also reinforces an archetype many straight men have to live under that is oftentimes unrealistic, less free, and limits individual expression. While Williams doesn't name names in the statement or even clarify whether he himself has been subject of such speculation, he's pointing to a very real phenomenon. Pop star Shawn Mendes has been forced to confirm that he is indeed straight after years of jokes online that he is gay, while an ardent subsection of Taylor Swift's fan base remain convinced that their gay lore theories are valid. Williams is also correct that this kind of speculation can have very real ramifications for actual members of the LGBTQ+ community. Earlier this year, Heartstopper star Kit Connor publicly came out as bisexual in response to the harassment he had received from fans who felt they had the right to discuss his private life. "I've been very clear about the intentionality I try to put into using my platform to push back against the archetypes every chance that I get," Williams continued. "Being straight doesn't look one way. Being gay doesn't look one way. And what may seem like harmless fun and conversation may actually be sending a dangerous message to those struggling with real issues. I refuse to inadvertently contribute to that message. Happy Pride Day to all of my queer and questioning brothers, sisters, and individuals. I pray that you feel seen in ways that make you feel safe in the celebration that is this month. As an ally, I continue to be committed to assisting in that where I can and helping to cultivate a future where we are all accepted and given permission to be ourselves." In books, we have 12 small towns that are rich in American history. Start planning your summer road trip. While we love a good museum, nothing pairs with exploring history in person. In addition to visual charm aplenty, these small towns across the U.S. boast rich histories, telling the story of the country and its inhabitants through their buildings. Whether you're escaping the big city for a weekend getaway or have your bags packed for a cross-country summer road trip, these small towns are worth a stop for the history buff and the design lover alike. So get your maps ready and start checking these towns off your bucket list. Galveston, Texas. Galveston is adorned with hundreds of historical markers that each cite the reading of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 on what is now known as Juneteenth. That day, Union troops enforced President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, signaling the official end of slavery. Celebrations include prayers, readings of the document, and parades. Juneteenth officially became recognized as a state holiday in 1979. Lake Placid, New York. During the 1800s, the upper class would vacation upstate in the Adirondacks, where Lake Placid soon became one of the first winter getaways. Wealthy families built an oasis of their own to escape their city lives and enjoy the mountainous scenery draped with snowfall in the colder months. The town has strong roots in sports, as the Olympic Winter Games were hosted there in 1932 and 1980. The buildings dating back from the first games were designed for future use, and Lake Placid became a premier winter sports center. With arenas built for the games, many Olympic skaters such as Dick Button and Dorothy Hamill have trained there. Williamsburg, Virginia. Williamsburg, Virginia was the first planned city of the United States and was founded as the capital of the Virginia colony in 1699. Protected historical sites include the Jamestown Settlement, Yorktown Battlefield, and Colonial Williamsburg. While parts of Colonial Williamsburg are rebuilt, visitors can sit in King William County Courthouse, the oldest courthouse in continuous use in America, which was first constructed in 1725. Aside from the historical sites, Williamsburg's downtown Merchant Square was one of the first planned shopping centers in the country. Some original businesses, such as the General Store, first opened in 1919, remain standing today. Marfa, Texas. Marfa, Texas was first established as a railway freight headquarters and water stop in 1883. The town is named after a fictional character in Fyodor, that's F-Y-O-D-E-R, Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, who is known for her creative and free spirit. Called one of America's last frontiers, Marfa became a base for World War II flight training in the 1940s. It wasn't until the 1970s that Marfa's reputation was deemed a place for creativity when artist Donald Judd left New York City to live there and create permanent installations. The film Giant, James Dean's last feature with Elizabeth Taylor, took place in town and brought interest to the Marfa ghost lights. To many today, Marfa is known for its Prada installation and a sculpture by Elm Green and Dragset that at first glance looks just like an ordinary storefront. Beaufort, North Carolina. Beaufort, North Carolina was established in 1709 and is one of the oldest towns statewide. Sitting on the coast, Beaufort was first known for fishing. Bahamian-style homes were very popular in the 18th century and many remain still today, marked with dates of original construction. Meanwhile, the Beaufort town remains today as it was first constructed in 1713. Poulsbo, Washington. That's P-O-U-L-S-B-O. This quaint town along Liberty Bay was originally inhabited by the Suquamish tribe. Seattle was actually named after their leader, Chief Seattle, before a Norwegian immigrant settled there and founded the town in the 1880s. Today, this little Norway today showcases the heritage of the Scandinavians from local businesses such as Poulsbo Bread and the Poulsbo Historical Museum. Sedona, Arizona. While the town of Sedona was established in 1876, the jaw-dropping red rock formations began more than 350 million years ago. This landscape soon became the hotspot for Western film settings. The first movie filmed in Sedona was Zane Grey's silent feature, Call of the Canyon, in 1923. Big names such as John Wayne, James Stewart, Robert De Niro, and many others worked on movies in this real-life movie set. Side streets that are now residential areas are named after films, such as Johnny Guitar, a Western released in 1954. Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Eureka Springs was founded on Independence Day in 1879. Legend of a great healing spring brought thousands of visitors who wished to be transformed by this healing water to the area. The water earned national recognition with Ozarka Bottling Company formed, and while there isn't any proof of these miracles, the spring water is still bottled today. Pioneertown, California. Pioneertown in California was designed as an Old West movie set in the 1940s by actors Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. Though it's not as old as you might think, its movie-ready building allude to earlier times. And now, even the set itself is historic. Pappy and Harriet's Pioneertown Palace hosted great entertainers such as Robert Plant and Leon Russell. Aside from being a fully functioning town, the village made appearances in over 50 films in the early 1940s. Sitka, Alaska. Only accessible by boat or airplane, Sitka has a history dating back 10,000 years when it was settled by the Tlingit tribe. That's T-L-I-N-G-I-T. This picturesque town, known for its fishing, whale watching, hiking, and kayaking, was a Russian-American capital until the American purchase of Alaska in 1867. A ceremonial lowering of the Russian flag and raising of the American flag has become a yearly tradition on Alaska Day, October 18th. Carmel by the Sea, California. Incorporated in 1916, Carmel by the Sea in California quickly becomes a place for creative refuge, with early residents such as author Jack London. Between the white sand beaches and dense forests, the early settlers camped in tents and cooked over fires among the wilderness. The Carmel Library is proof that literature and the arts are held in high regard in Carmel by the Sea. Nearly 3,000 volumes, including issues of the local paper, poetry, and theater scripts, can be found at the library. Actor Clint Eastwood served as town mayor from 1986 to 88. Taos, New Mexico. Before being incorporated as a town in 1934 and recognized as the soul of the Southwest, Taos began thousands of years ago when the Taosifrios people built pueblos into rock formations and created pottery with natural resources. As this area continued to become a creative refuge, a group of individuals started the Taos Society of Artists in 1915. Soon after, Taos became home to painters and writers such as Aldous Huxley, and author of Brave New World, American painter Georgia O'Keeffe, and many more. On the O list of things best of spring to buy, there's the Williams-Sonoma Flower Shop Ice Cream Cone Cake Kit. It's $50 at Williams-Sonoma. Whip up some whimsy with this kit that comes with the goods to make 12 frosted cupcakes baked into ice cream cones. The perfect activity for kids and kids at heart. And the Sunny Life Swim Vests. They're $55 at sunnylife.com. It's too bad these adorable neoprene swim vests with photo-worthy 3D designs are just for the little ones. Your kiddo may want to keep it on post-pool time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.